That is much is best.
And the hole in the vault to pass food and water through, that made a deep impression on the children. Yes.
The House Committee on Revenue for February 20, 2009 will come to order. Colleagues, of course, we just heard the state economist give his revenue forecast for March. We appreciate your being able to give it to us a few days early, it being one of those important kinds of pieces of information for the legislature to do in its planning. And, of course, I announced at that time that this meeting would not be to receive the report, which has already happened in the House chamber, but rather to give members a chance to ask questions and to clarify anything about the report that they may believe may need clarifying. I'll ask if there are other members here who want to ask questions. If there's space at the podium, you come up. If not, we'll figure out another way to get you on the record for your question. And thank you very much. Give us your for the record, and then we'll ask for questions.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart, Chair Burdick, and members of the House Revenue Committee and members of the Senate Revenue and Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Pitowski, State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis and Department of Administrative Services. I think what if we do have a short PowerPoint that goes a little more detail, we could dispense with that and go right to questions, whatever the committees would like.
I have no problem with the PowerPoint. I think we have until noon, don't we? Okay. So if we take a few minutes for that, and then we'll still have some time for the questions that the members have, and you may answer some of them in the meantime. And we also welcome Treasurer Westland, and there may be some questions for you as well. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Just very briefly, the situation in the U.S. economy really has in a sense, changed rather dramatically since when we released the December forecast, which was basically mid-November. We're seeing that the U.S. has gone definitely into a deep recession. The fourth quarter, it really hit a wall. The financial sector is in turmoil. Housing market is still continuing to slide. One bright point is that inflation, which was a big worry just last summer, has since gone away. And the expectation is that this recovery, if there is an economic recovery, it should begin next summer, but basically not seeing any good growth until we get to the second half of 2010. And as it says down there, risks still are somewhat concentrated on the downside. For Oregon, we're at a 10% unemployment rate. As we said, next week, the Oregon Employment Department will release the numbers for January. My expectation is that we will continue to see job losses for January, and the unemployment rate probably will be above 9%. The 41st fastest job growth, that's our nice way of saying we have the ninth slowest job growth of all the states. total farm employment has dropped by 2.5%. This is quite a turnaround. When we looked at the third quarter to third quarter, it was down only less than 1%. So that is another aspect of this sort of fourth quarter hitting the wall for us. Personal income growth has also slowed quite dramatically from the plus 6% rate that we saw back in 2005-2006. And then although exports were up 17% for the whole year, notice that they've fallen 6% in the fourth quarter over the fourth quarter. And this is just another aspect of, that was one of the parts that were kind of holding up the Oregon economy were exports, and now that leg has gone away. This is a comparison. We do sort of three scenarios. The baseline is what would we report as the most likely outcome in the numbers you heard today. But we also have a pessimistic and optimistic outlook. I might point out that the baseline forecast for personal income in 2009 is even less than what the personal income growth turned out to be in 2001 and 2002. So in retrospect, we actually have this downturn as being somewhat larger, really, in as it expands over these two biennium periods than what we had in the 2001-2003 period. And this is just gives some perspective on the size of the recession compared to past recessions. The top line where it says employment gives employment losses for the U.S. and for Oregon. And you can see that in the 80-82 period, Oregon had a drop of about 11.5% of jobs from its peak. We're looking at something about 5.8% we're projecting out for this biennium. Notice that that is larger than the 2001 and then the 90-91 recession, which we didn't feel much pain hardly at all during that period. In terms of lengths of recession, this will be slightly longer when we finally return back to the peak in the recession that we're in now. Although it only says 8 quarters for Oregon relative to, I have 8 quarters here for Oregon relative to the 10 quarters from the last biennium, this is a shorter period of time by 2 quarters, but it's a deeper drop than what occurred in the 10 quarters of 2001. So it's a much steeper drop in our job aspects. And then the 19 quarters returning over here is our view that, well, we do come out of this, but it takes longer to get back to the same level of employment we were before the recession as opposed to what it did back in 2001. This is our outlook for the job growth. You can see the drop in 2008 and then, of course, the much steeper drop here in 2009 with barely an uptick in 2010. And it's not really till, I said, for example, these are yearly averages, so it's not really till the second half of 2010 that we think we start to see some more decent growth. But you can see this is a three-year aspect, and in essence, this is also a three-year aspect, centered more on 2009. And then our forecast comparisons, the light color is last September, the shade next is December, the dark black is the present forecast. And you can see that our view dramatically has changed since September as we were going into this recession. Also on the personal income side, quite a dramatic change and also a slower growth coming out of it. Now, that essentially leads for our economic outlook then into our revenue outlook that Josh Harwood will present to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the House and Senate Revenue Committees. I'm Josh Harwood. I'm with the Office of Economic Analysis. The first slide we have here is just the news you've already heard. What we're seeing is, in general, is both greater volatility in the tax base, but also increasing volatility over time. So we already know, you've heard it before, that we have a volatile tax base because of our income tax structure. We're susceptible to wide swings in capital gains and business income. The share of total income attributable to capital gains and business income has grown over time. And so as a result, absent any forecast, any of those things, your simple revenue stream is more volatile than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And so that has been built into this forecast. That level of volatility has been built into some of the numbers that you see here, recognizing that that volatility also leads to wider error ranges over time, especially as we look 3, 4, 5 years out. I think, as Tom mentioned, we're now forecasting, from a revenue perspective, a longer in particular, but also a deeper drop in revenue. I think the easiest way to put some context on it is if 2008-10 were a biennium, it might look, from a revenue stream, similar to 2001-03. And that it just happens to be that we're straddling the biennium from a revenue perspective in particular. And so that's where we're finding that. It's a loose correlation, but I think that provides some context sort of what you're looking at. Go ahead. This is something that you've seen before. It's just our general fund resources for the 07-09 biennium. The bottom number here is the number that Tom mentioned, the 855.3. It's an additional $713 million down. Concentrated in personal income taxes, but we're also seeing some corporate income tax erosion as well. There are some risks that are specific to the corporate income tax, in particular with respect to tax credits and those kinds of things that we're still flushing out in terms of its implementation and use in the business community. Real quick, lottery revenue forecast really did sort of hit the perfect storm. Lottery revenues really fell off the table beginning in November. And that's when the economic slowdown hit it hard. Additionally, lower gas prices. Anecdotally, casinos have seen increases, or did see an increase in November in activity versus the prior 3, 4, 5 months. So we think there's some substitution effect that's going on there with lottery. But more importantly, things like weather hit. We saw about a 20% drop attributable generally to the weather for a couple of weeks in salary, in lottery revenues. And then, of course, the smoking restrictions that went into place. As Tom mentioned in the chambers, the lottery has told us that they will have about $21.3 million in additional administrative savings to transfer in April of this year, and that will keep the whole 2007 9 by 8 harmless for purposes of the close of session forecast, which was budgeted on. However, sales are expected to decline about 14% relative to 07-09, and remember that 07-08 was a really strong year. And so that's being built in, and that's what's leading to some of that drop. That 14% does not include any anticipated administrative savings from lottery that would occur in the next biennium. A couple of risks to the forecast. The timing and nature of the rebound speaks to the volatility that we're seeing. Should the market in particular turn around, should equity markets turn around and solidify earlier than expected, we will see a bump in capital gains revenue. And we'd expect once confidence comes back to some measure, lottery will see a bump as well relatively quickly. Inflationary factors are working to lower the low inflation forecast dampens any wage and salary increases over a long haul. And so that's also hitting the forecast somewhat. And, of course, the global economy. I think Tom underscored the weakness in exports for the fourth quarter of this last year. And depending on how the global economy works out, Oregon is susceptible to, in particular, to Asian markets with respect to their export industries, and that provides quite a significant portion of the tax base here in Oregon. So I'll turn it back over to Tom here just to wrap it up before questions.
Yeah, so we're, of course, it's our job to continue to monitor and assess what's happening with the economy and the revenue conditions that are out there. As I say here, if we see any stark deviations from the March forecast, we will provide tracking update with commentary similar to what we did in the July 16th update. But having said that, you know, given the timing of the April final payments, processing returns, any sort of realization, I think, of true deviations from this March forecast, if they're going to show up, they'll probably show up just as we're finishing the May forecast. So to that extent, we may not provide you with an update other than saying that things are still possibly tracking in sort of more, maybe more informal ways than doing a formal update at this time.
Thank you very much. You get your big piece of information with the April 15th returns, and analyzing them takes you right up to the time of the May forecast.
Yes, and Representative Barnhart, also just the processing time.
Right.
I mean, because a
yes.
huge amount of mail comes in, and to be able to process those, get that information out, that spills into the beginning of May.
Right, but at that time, many people have closed up their tax year. We'll have a better sense of where taxpayers think they are anyway. Thank you. Representative Gilser.
Yes, sir. I have a question. Is it
Please.
Time for questions?
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Now's the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that detailed presentation and for your willingness to come back previously to give us the tracking update so that today wasn't quite as much of a surprise as it might have been had you not come forward earlier this year with a tracking update. When you look forward to 2009-11, and today we saw the additional over $1 billion projected shortfall, does that take into account the kinds of actions that the state will need to take relative to the shortfall in this biennium and next biennium, including job loss and the numbers of layoffs and furlough days? Can you talk a little bit about what type of impact state and public workers have on the economy and whether or not increasing unemployment in that sector will further drive the shortfall in the next biennium?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser. For our forecast, we are looking at the flow of revenues coming in. And to the extent that government workers on furloughs would not be paying a income tax for those particular days, that will have some marginal impact. But in terms of the short budget shortfall, we're giving that kind of as an informational aspect, because our office won't be concentrating on what possible expenditures may change or what cuts you may make in order to close that budget fall. Our emphasis will always be on what is happening on the revenue side to affect that equation.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
Yes, please.
Just to clarify, I think that where my mind is going, and I know that we have to make the decisions and you build on that, but with the shortfalls that we're looking at and knowing that 93% of our budget is made up in education, human services, and public safety, all of which are services that are provided by people that make a wage and then pay taxes, to the extent that we will cut in this biennium $855 million out of those jobs and in the next biennium a minimum of $3 billion out of those types of jobs, is that accounted for in that shortfall, or will our reductions further drive that unemployment rate and the income as it tracks coming in on the revenue side, and how significantly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, we do have in our forecast a drop of local and state government employment, and that works back through our model in terms of how that will influence tax revenues. So, you know, we have what some people like to call it a mixed economy, where we have a public sector and a private sector. But I've always made the statements that, you know, I do the analogy that if, you know, you're in a town and you have a dry cleaner and a state prison guard comes in, they don't have a separate cash register for that public employee that's separate from the private sector. They're both the same. It's just one cash register. And so if that guard isn't employed anymore, they aren't spending at that dry cleaner. And so it does impact our economy. And, you know, we're not the federal government. Because if we were, we would not be cutting spending or thinking about raising taxes or some combination to balance the budget during recessionary time. We'd be doing what the federal government is doing, which is deficit spending. But also, we don't have the ability to do what the federal government does. So, yes, it does indirectly affect us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, in your remarks earlier, you had said that the stimulus was one of the variables that's at play here, and I'm wondering if you can touch on the economic advantages and disadvantages to using more stimulus dollars now as opposed to using more stimulus dollars later, and the kind of ripple effect that we could see through the economy with those policy decisions that are being made. And if you could give us give a bit of the pros and cons on each side of that, given that there seems to be many philosophical differences at play right now about when we should be using those dollars.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Cahill. We actually have had that sort of discussion in the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, and we have quite a mix of philosophical beliefs and ideals in that group. Some people feel that, you know, given the
size of the recession and how quickly things have gone down, it is best to get dollars moving as quickly as possible. Now, the debate there is that the spending should be done right away. Some people would say, well, who should do the spending? One aspect says the government is the one that should go out and do construction jobs, whatever, shovel ready, those that can be done almost immediately. Other view is that, well, we can, in a sense, indirectly have spending occur. We cut taxes, and thus we have households increase their spending right away. The other philosophical debate on that is, well, households are scared right now. And what we may see is that if you give them a tax cut, they're going to do what the financial institutions are doing, bumping up, you know, shoring up their balance sheets. And so they will simply save that money rather than spend it. So if you're going to get it spent, at least the first round, you should do it through the government. Also, the philosophical debate is that people are seeing all this stimulus spending that is out there, and they are sure that all this means is that my taxes will be raised in the future. So if I'm going to prepare for this and prepare for my other generations beyond me that will be facing this higher tax bill, today I have to start to save in order to pass that money on to my heirs so that they don't have the burden of paying for those taxes. Thus, the spending right away today is not going to have much of an impact. Other people believe that that's sort of nonsense, and people don't really believe that way, and their discount factor is very, very high, and they say today is what you live for, and they will spend it today and not worry about the future. So it really is across the board as to the beliefs on this.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Yes, please.
Maybe I can probe just a tiny bit more deeply, and then I'll quit asking questions so everyone else can have a chance. So I guess on the last point, I guess the federal stimulus is a reality. So how people are going to react to the fact that we've already decided to spend that money, I hope, is maybe mooted. I mean, if they're going to do that, then they're going to do that, and that's going to be the reaction that we get from the federal stimulus. So specifically, to maybe this is probing into Representative Gelser's question, we have potential cuts on the horizon in our budgets, most certainly cuts coming. And I'm wondering what the wisdom is of using what the pros and cons are of using stimulus dollars now to kind of shore up our current budget, and you know, the best shovel ready job is keeping a teacher in a classroom, in my opinion. That's a shovel ready job, in my opinion, how the world works. And so I want to really try to understand what the difference is between shoring up the economy now or waiting, holding off and waiting till 09/11. And it seems to me that that's, when you said that the stimulus package is a variable still, it seems to me that that's a big variable in your ability to even analyze what the outcomes of the stimulus package are going to be. So I'm just trying to get a sense of how that works.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kale. One, I will say, possibly the Treasurer can speak to this also. Your ability to, at the state level, to provide a stimulus spending right now is limited. And to the size that it could be is always, in my mind, helpful. But in order to really turn the tide, it's probably not large enough. Only the federal government has that kind of size capability. Now, we've got to watch to see how this recession unfolds completely. And the uncertainties are is that the hole could be larger as we're moving into the next biennium. Even though if we spend today, that may shore things up today a little bit, but have you then used up all your capability today to a problem that may come down the road? So it's a balancing act, I think, as to, you know, fiscally how you address this.
Yeah, if the only issue were stimulus, the obvious solution would be to spend the money now. But we, of course, have to deal with a bunch of other issues, too, having to do with state of taking care of basic programs and making decisions about maintenance of basic programs over time. So that complicates the question the representative call is asking. And that question, of course, is one that the legislature has to wrestle with, and we will over the next few months. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dr. Potowski, for your presentation. I think you mentioned during the presentation on the House floor that you thought that the freezing up of credit was probably our primary problem. I made the mistake of checking the stock market in between the meetings and noticed it was down substantially, and the primary focus of today's action is the banks, and they are down dramatically. If that indeed is the cause of our current problem, what do you suggest or recommend we do at the state level to address the freezing up of credit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, it's very difficult, I think, at the state level to make a change on the financial system. It really is national, international in scope. And if anything, is to provide support to our U.S. representatives to try to do some legislation to help this situation. In my mind, at that level, I like the idea of a bad bank, which is setting up an institution that can take some of the bad assets off of the books. Because my fear now is that as this thing unfolds, they re-evaluate, they mark what they call mark-to-market, the value of the assets keep coming down, any money that you flow in, they just simply put it in the capital account to get the balance sheet back up again. So I think if you can get those bad assets off of their books first, I think would be more beneficial way to go. But at the state level, I really don't know what you can do because it's a national, international problem.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question follows on the question of Representative Benz dealing with our financial sector. Two questions. Does anyone, including the federal government, know the true extent of the crisis that we have with the financial assets that are held, not just in commercial banks, but in investment banks and throughout that broad financial sector? Do we really know what the problem is? Has it been quantified? And the second question is the discussion now that's floating around the nationalization of our commercial banks. What implication does that have for us in our, you know, the risks that you've identified in our revenue forecast?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the first item, that is part of the problem, and no one is quite sure of the valuation of what these bad assets are, how many truly are out there. Because they're just very strange animals. They're not even sure what backs, you know, the particular new asset that's been sold out there. So that is a major problem, the extent of what that is. And then the second, the nationalization of the banks, we've taken a step in that direction in a sense already, with the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, in essence, taking equity positions in these institutions. So for our revenue outlook, my concern is that if there is a nationalization, and I don't know if that's the answer, but whatever is that we do that finally provides a degree of confidence back in those financial institutions where they're willing to then recognize that risk is not necessarily a bad thing, but there's probabilistic, reasonable risk for loaning. It's how our system works, rather than this completely no-confidence position. Then that is what will affect our revenues. If that financial system starts to come back, then normal business procedures will start to come back. And that's what we need to get back to this recovery.
Thank you.
Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, I hate to ask this question, but I think having a little bit of pre-understanding is better than not having a little bit of pre-understanding. What does, and can you scale it, what does a major in-country terrorist event do to your numbers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, I hate to even think about it. It would definitely bring them down. What our previous experience, of course, is 9/11. We did see quite a drop in consumer spending at that time, but it was rather short-lived. I just think on the household psyche right now, having something like that happen, they would retrench even further, and it would be very devastating to all economies.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, and I think that's most of that is assumed. I guess I'm wondering, based on the numbers you're showing us, based on the shortfalls we're seeing in the next biennium and the employment we're seeing, is there any way to scale that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, I don't know. My feeling would be at this point is that it would be down further, definitely. I don't know if it'd be tough for me to say whether it'd be double what we're looking at now. What I would say in relative sense is that if the economy was doing fairly well and we had the situation happen, that would be a larger drop than when we're already towards the bottom and having this on top of it.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Burdick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You pointed out in your presentation that capital gains capital gains have been playing an increasing role in the Oregon revenue stream. Can you give us a little more, one of you, a little more elaboration on, look at this whole situation we're in from the lens of capital gains, how they've contributed to the shortfall as we come out of the recovery, how they're likely to behave. And, I just looked at my computer again, the stock market, actually it's rebounded up to 7,300 now. What impact all that has on it, because we certainly know we're not an island unto ourselves. And so I think just to get a fix on capital gain, I'm particularly concerned about the upside risk of having a sudden upsurge in capital gain trigger a kicker as we're still fighting our way through the recession. So if one of you could address that.
I'll take a breather.
Thanks. Senator Burdick, committee members. There's a couple things, I guess, just for background. Capital gains and what we call Schedule E income, a lot of business income and rents and stuff, that was averaged about 10% of our income base through the 90s. It's about 15% now. So, and as it contributes to volatility, it can be upwards of 3/4 of the volatility in the income stream. I think that sort of as a backdrop. The other thing that's happening, an outfit out of Washington did a study about income inequality and income distributions. And Oregon, relative to other states, is actually the difference between sort of the middle of the road incomes and the high incomes, that gap grew about the second fastest of all 50 states in the last 10 years. So you've got this compounding factor of your very high end income taxpayers are also getting further away from your sort of general tax base, and that gap is widening, and that's putting more emphasis in terms of your volatility on a smaller number of taxpayers. That having been said, what you talk about is exactly right. There is some susceptibility to those markets turning around. Capital gains, in particular, especially at the high end, on our revenue advisory committee, we have a group of CPAs that work with high-end clients, those types of things to try to get a handle on what exactly you're saying. And what happens in a year like we just had, because you can only deduct a very small portion or very small amount from your general income related to capital gains, what they do is they offset maybe some investments, and they quite honestly probably didn't have too many to do this last year, but they, at the end of the year, they'll tend to offset capital losses for the year. So what that does is sort of, to some degree, puts every year in a vacuum. And so if we know that the stock market 2 years from now is going to go up 30% that year, there is absolutely a risk of having exactly what you describe. The problem that we have and that every state has is that we don't know that. If we did, as we often say, we could be making a lot more money somewhere else. That's just sort of the reality of the situation. And it can even be different within states depending on their tax structures in a given year. Some states may be up, some states may be down. And it's just one of those things that that we will always struggle with, I think, is the way to describe it.
Well, Mr. Chair, to follow up, if the situation continues the way it looks like it's going, do you expect the percentage of capital gain, you know, you said it's gone from 10% in the 90s to 15% in more recent years, do you expect its importance to decline in the next biennium if things are as we expect them to be?
Senator Burdick, its importance is sort of a difficult measurement. I mean, the reality is that it'll be less than 15% for tax year 2008 because we're expecting capital gains to drop by about 55% relative to 2007 as a component of income. So in a vacuum, you're right, it will be lower, but it'll still have a lot of influence to the extent that it has variability. It will have a lot of influence potentially on any errors to the forecast over the next 2 years. We are not expecting to see a huge rebound. We're expecting 2009 to be weak again. And then 2010, we expect a little bit of a bounce back, but nothing nowhere near the levels we saw in 2007.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the bank situation question again. I believe you indicated that your forecast assumed that there was a federal fix of the bank problem. I may be misremembering that, but can you tell us when your forecast anticipates that fix and what we might take from that if it doesn't happen?
Representative Benz. Be hard pressed to put a date on when that exactly happens, and actually the forecast sees it as a, you know, if it's frozen now, there's this thaw that occurs, and it's going to unfold over time, so it won't be like a light switch, you know, on or off, but we're expecting that to start to settle down mid this year. Not that there's going to be a huge amount of new credit and lending that's going to be happening, but it's going to slowly improve about that time. And it's not going to be really till we get 2010 that things are much improved for the financial system.
Yes, please. Yeah.
But again, that assumes some sort of a fix. Is that correct, what you just said?
Yes.
A fix.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, in the sense that the policies that the Federal Reserve is doing, the Treasury Department, whatever other policies may be done on the housing side to help homeowners and so that those mortgages don't go belly up, there's a fix at work. And we assume that, yes, the financial system doesn't get worse. It actually does start to improve. So this whole combination of, we might call them fixes, is starting to take effect.
Thank you.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for all of this information from all the people who are watching the stock market on their iPhones up here, I'm beginning to think that the market is actually watching Oregon and reacting to our little microcosm here. My question really is about unemployment generally, and I know that in the stimulus package there is a pretty big allotment of money to the states to encourage states to expand eligibility for unemployment so that more people who are suffering in this downturn can actually have a safety net. Do the figures that you're giving us assume that we are taking advantage of those monies? I think it's approximately $90 million that's available in third chunks. Part of it's for administration, but most of it is expanding unemployment benefits.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosenbaum. We do in the extent, it's pretty tough to put it right at the dollar amount at the state. Through our usage of the Global Insight national forecast, which has worked in basically the level of the stimulus package that was assigned February 17th by President Obama, and the aspect that we think we're pretty much going to be, you know, our share is going to be pretty much what we expect it to be, that works into all those type of employment numbers. And as far as I know, Oregon is not making any statements like South Carolina and possibly saying we're not going to take this money. So I believe, yes, it is in this sort of in more indirect way worked into our outlook.
More for us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wouldn't want Treasurer Westland to escape today without a hard ball. Okay. But first, the softball. Two questions. One is, there's been a lot of discussion about our stability funds, and the statement has been made that if we were to draw on those funds, it then changes the credit rating of our state. And I'd like you, maybe if you could respond to that question. And then the second question would be with respect to the amount of indebtedness that we might incur in the plan for the 9/11 biennium. You were in your remarks fairly guarded about not spending to the maximum, and I'm wondering if you have some recommendation of what you would consider to be prudent in light of the substantially declining revenues and the debt service that it takes to finance any of that debt that carried forward, to the extent that it reduces our ability to even fund basic services, and how much debt would be prudent in that context.
For the record, State Treasurer Ben Westland, Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senator Morris, thank you for those questions. With regard to the first one, reserve fund spending, how does that affect our credit rating? I am so happy to be able to use this phrase with authenticity, as my good friend Mr. Poltowski uses so often. On the one hand, and then on the other, there is excuse me, no right answer or no wrong answer to that question. It's part of a larger, more complex calculus with regard to what else we are doing. That question can only be answered in the context of a larger equation. If we just go and spend the reserve funds and do nothing else, in my opinion, that would certainly impact our credit rating. If we have a package of painfully and regrettably the substantive cuts and revenue options in that mix, it would probably have less impact. And of course, that is all measured against potential revenue losses as we go forward. I will tell you that when I made my rounds with the the rating agencies. They were very impressed. This is to keeping Oregon's credit rating healthy and stable. The two things they are most impressed with Oregon's, quote, plan and demonstrated actions to that date were, one, our resolve to continue to improve our initiative process. And I thank you for your leadership on that issue, Senator Morris. But the second was that they were very impressed by the fact that Governor Kulongoski, you know, had not done the easy thing and gone in his governor's recommended budget to, you know, immediately spending the reserves to do the easy thing first. So the real answer to your question is, what actions, what difficult actions are we going to take to balance the budget prior to going to do the easier thing of utilizing rainy day funds? That's as good and straightforward an answer as I can give you. If we get to that point, I would strongly recommend that the first fund to be tapped is the Education Stability Fund, because the raters understand that that has an automatic refill provision, and then we don't have to pass additional legislation to make that fund, you know, continue to grow. With regard to overall indebtedness, again, the fundamental issue, what's our cap, what's our limit? You know, there is nothing written in stone that we should only spend with regard to general fund obligations, a cap up to 5%. And that's just kind of the generally accepted accounting principle. It's not just good budgeting. You know, it's good business practices. And that's what the raters are most concerned about. It's how we behave, what plans we have. And it really gets back to my first answer about the rainy day funds. It's do the hard stuff first. Do the really hard stuff first. And that would really be my strongest admonition to the committee, because, you know, I understand these are very fluid projections. But I think we all know, and it's why I put the 10% less recommendation, or the 10% less revenue column on my handout. This isn't getting better. You know, we'll be incredibly lucky, beyond fortunate, you know, if there's not another significant downturn, not just in May, which I know we're all anticipating, is close the session, and it's really the holy grail, and that's where we balance, you know, the 07, 09 by any amount to, and what we balance to in 09, 11. But this guy, we're going to be seeing him again, you know, in 3 months after we get out of here. And then again, and again, and again. You know, we are far from having the last negative number in this whole scenario. So I hope that answers your question, Senator Morse, but, you know, there's not a yes, no, this, that answer.
Thank you, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, perhaps for Mr. Patowski or whoever would choose to answer this, what economic factors affect whether or not stimulus dollars, whether through the state or through the federal government, get spent and have a stimulative effect in the economy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, what we're sort of looking at is you've got, if you're spending dollars from the government, that is a direct dollar spending. And so whatever they spent that on, whether it's workers, whether it's equipment, whatever it might be, is a direct spending. Now, what happens after that, in terms of further aspects or stimulative rounds that might occur, are related to then whoever received those payments, to what extent they also turn around and spend it. Now, there's some belief that something they call the marginal propensity to consume. So if you have an extra dollar of income, what's your extra spending out of that? And there's a belief that people at the lower income levels have a higher propensity to spend out of extra income than people at higher income levels. They might tend to save more than people at lower incomes. So to the extent that that's spending another dollars would be at a lower income, there should be further more spending because of that than as opposed to higher income. Now, there's also, given how the economy is sitting right now, there's kind of a confidence question. And to the extent that people feel nervous about their job security, just about the future, they may tend to hoard the money more so than spend it, given all other conditions as they might be. So with those kind of factors, I think that's what we're struggling against right now is with the stimulus packages, is that households may be reluctant to actually spend as they would during if they felt a little better about the economy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, would it also then depend on what happens to the overall price level in the economy if it's dependent on the respending of those dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, right now, to the extent that we have a relatively low inflation, more, in a sense, goods and services can be bought at a lower inflation than would have been at a higher inflation. But as the dynamics, and we have moving through time, if this would somehow cause a higher inflation, we might then have workers getting higher wages because they're demanding these because they can't keep up with the inflation, and then we get into, you know, the lots of spending still happens, but it all happening now at higher inflation rates. Or the same kind of action can happen at a lower inflation rate if we don't have some of these other cost factors kick in.
And I'll follow up, Mr. Chair. So if I'm hearing you correctly, and correct me if I'm not, it sounds like there are two primary factors. There's the overall level of inflation, and then there's also, it sounds like perhaps even more importantly, the perception of individuals to respend those dollars in the economy, whether that's related to their own income, their expectation of future income, their expectation of services. So I guess that tees up a comment / question. It sounds like we need to give people hope about the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, yes, I really think that the price level itself is not a big issue in how much people would spend. But it is how they feel about their own future economic well-being as to how much they will spend.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I have a comment, and it may lead to a question, I think, for the Treasurer. You had a very successful bond sale just a little bit ago, and you talked in your report in the Chamber about opening that bond sale up for the first time for essentially retail sales to mostly Oregonians, I assume, although I suspect other people bought too, and that you got a very good interest rate compared to the going rate that seems to be around right now. I think almost a point better, if I remember correctly. Another term that comes to mind is this term flight to quality. When times are bad, people dump other currencies and buy dollars, so the dollar goes up in the market internationally, which has happened. And I'm wondering if in your view, the same might be happening with the kind of municipal bonds that you have for sale. given the sale that you just had?
Chair Bertie, Chair Barnhart, thank you for the question. And let me back up to give some maybe fuller context to this, answering this question that is directly related to your point. When I went down to give my first presentation to the rating agencies, Oregon was one of a handful of states that, based on our actual fiscal performance and responsibility, had the prospect of not getting our bonds upgraded but being notched up to consideration for that. It's a very specific process where you notch up to informal but important classifications and then get the improved bond rating. Same on the way down. You notch down to a kind of, yellow level of concern, and then you notch down to a, a red level of concern, and then they downgrade you. We had the prospect of getting notched up. That did not occur. However, relative to, the other states, and there's 15 or 17 in this category, they kept their bond rating but notched down. Our bonds became more desirable because we held stable. We all sell into the same markets. We all compete for the same buyers, in essence. So our bonds, took on an additional level, as you say, quality, flight to quality. What we did on the retail side for the first time ever, we've sold bonds retail or tried to before with some success. We'd usually get into the 10, 15, 20% commitment level from Oregon citizens. We established, and I encourage everyone to look at it and suggest improvements, created the buyoregonbonds.com webpage. We got quite a bit of earned media. Did no, paid advertising, no radio spots. And for the first time ever, we had commitments of over $130 million, more than 50% of the total issuance. We couldn't sell $130 million because we'd allocated our level to $103 million. And so if we sold over that, we're starting to impact our traditional institutional buyers. So, but the other good news is all of our institutional buyers were oversubscribed. And so how this then happens is they commit to a price range. Your interest rate will be, and depending on the issuance, we had 10-year, 20-year, 30-year, this is the range of interest you will be paid. If you become overcommitted, you enjoy, as a seller, the ability, okay, now we're going to talk pricing. Well, we obviously have, it's just a negotiation. We obviously have more, demand for our product than we have product. So we were able to lower our interest rate payments within that range, as opposed to, tepid sale. No one's really quite having to entice it by raising it up. I don't know if that fully answers your question, but it was a very significant, very successful, and gives all indications that for the continued debt issuance we will do, already on the books, already legislated for the rest of this biennium, that we will again enjoy, quote, robust, highly desirable sales.
Thank you. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Westland, what words of wisdom do you have for us as we go into the next biennium with a $3 billion shortfall? Looking at our credit rating, what words of wisdom do you have for us to protect our credit rating while we go through this very difficult time?
Caution, caution, prudence. We don't know the depth of this, really. So my first recommendation, as painful and difficult as this is, and many of you on the dais went through this back in 2002 as, and then the sixth special session in the sitting session of 03. We've been through this before, and we know, I say this with a great deal of empathy and, you know, shared painful experience. Do the hard things first. That should be your guiding star. Because we're looking at Tom's reports and taking that as a snapshot. And granted, that's what everyone's going to be working to balance to off this February forecast. But the more important one's coming in May. So my admonition is getting us not just into 09-11, but to 09-11 is don't do the easy stuff. That's code for, and I'll just say it. You know, I would really suggest you hold on to the rainy day funds until you get to May and see where you are. Because you don't know what's coming in May. And if we get really shot out of the saddle in May, what are you going to do? They're, granted, it's raining. Things are tough. These are not, you know, either cuts that anyone wants to see made. They're politically difficult. This is a political process, and we're all born in political waters. So I understand the winds that buffet, you know, up and down these halls now at ever-increasing hurricane-force winds. Mine the federal stimulus dollars for everything you can legitimately use for rebalance, both in terms of 07, 09, and 11. But the good news is we still have rational amounts of money we can use for debt issuance. In addition, and all we're talking about here is net taxpayer-supported debt. We have revenue bonds. We have private private interest bonding authority. We have 501c3 mission, philanthropic, charitable institution bonding we can do, not impacting our general fund or lottery debt capacity. So we have tools. So my admonition to you, and I accept, I think I'm hearing your admonition to me, is, you know, we need to work together. The Treasurer's Office can help and add solutions. But the first thing is do the tough stuff first. And that's what our rating agencies are looking at. And believe me, that bond rating, our credit rating, it's critical.
Yeah, that's correct. Thank you. Other questions? I want to thank you all very much for coming here this morning to advise the legislature about these issues. We appreciate the careful work, Dr. Potowski, that you and your department do to keep us informed of where we are. We'd rather you brought us better news, but it's important that we get as accurate news as we can, and we appreciate it very much. And Treasurer Westland, thank you very much for your advice. I know you've been involved in a number of budgets. I recall that we had to borrow over $400 million in 2003 to get us out of the budget, and we're still paying interest and principal on that amount, and I hope we can avoid doing anything like that in the end of this biennium and on into the next one. Thank you very much, and with that, we are adjourned.
They're all moving parts.